do it? And I said, well, if I'm doing it for my family, everything is easy. So sending money at home, it makes me happy.
I'm Gordon Peake, the host of Memorandum of Understanding from the Development Policy Centre, a podcast series that peers behind the bureaucratic curtain to tell the story of the people, policies and politics of international aid. It's tempting in development to think of everything as a statistic or a number. But our time in Warrnambool with some of the participants in the Pacific Labour Scheme showed that statistics or numbers can only get you so far. Welcome to the second of a two-episode MOU mini-series that explores the Australian Government's Pacific Labour Scheme. To recap, the scheme is a temporary migration program that helps employers in rural and regional Australia fill gaps in their rosters by hiring people from nine Pacific Island nations and Timor-Leste. And just to correct the record from the previous episode, the Development Policy Centre has been researching Pacific labour mobility since 2010, not 2015, as we said. We focused in the first episode on the hard yakka that is the daily grind inside the meatworks in Warrnambool. In this episode, you'll find us leaving the factory gates and heading out into the community to find that, in practice, the PLS is so much more than simply a stratagem for filling gaps on Australia's assembly lines. It gives 2,500 or so young people from the Pacific, a region where families are large, employment is scarce, and wages low, a chance to provide for their loved ones and shape their futures in a way that likely otherwise they could not. It is a migration program that absolutely aids families in the Pacific. The PLS and similar schemes challenge also the conception of what aid is, who works on it, and who benefits from it. The money that flows from wage packets earned in places like Warrnambool to Timor-Leste and the Pacific is very much hard-earned, rather than handed out to government or paid out in the form of technical assistance, workshops and trainings. This is a situation where the key stakeholders are very much doing it for themselves. You work and you get paid, and how you spend that money is up to you. And as we discovered in this episode, it doesn't take a complex monitoring and evaluation system to see that what this means for most people is helping their kinfolk and communities with selflessness and fortitude that honestly puts many of us in the wealthy West to shame. What we saw in Warrnambool and talk about in this podcast are people who can and will learn what they need to endure any sort of loneliness or hardship, exile themselves from their homeland in order to do their bit to ensure that in this time of unprecedented ecological and economic uncertainty, the younger generation have access to the things that they did not. They are, in every sense of the word, building their own capacity. And they are, in a very real sense, a heroic bunch. And the obvious question that arises is to why the narrow door that is the PLS cannot be opened wider. What sets the PLS apart from conventional forms of assistance that Australia has provided its neighbours is the mutuality that runs through it. In this instance, a knitting together of fortunes between the south coast of Australia with a small island nation to its north. And as we found in many of the conversations and interactions that we had in Warrnambool, the presence of the East Timorese, as well as fellow workers drawn from the Pacific and elsewhere, is having subtle but real effects on the people of this town. I felt it. Producer Julia felt it too. But the change, like so many we have charted in this series, is better understood as a character-driven story rather than the language of officialdom or numbers on a bar chart. It's like trying to explain fully what happens in a soccer match just by stating the final score. A metaphor that came to me when I was standing on the sidelines at the Deakin University campus in Warrnambool alongside Terezinha Kaur, the woman from Delhi that we met in the previous episode. Who is playing?
Timor is in Vietnam.
And who are the Timorese players? What are their names?
We have Cornelio, Octavio, Alarico, Alvarigo, Nazario for the Vietnam group, Noah, Fiki, and some of Timor is mixed together with the Vietnam. I have Alberto, Bong, and Angelo.
And you all work together in the midfield meet?
Yes, we work together.
So who do you think is going to win the game?
I think Vietnam will win. They already had 2 goals.
So who wins most weeks, Timor-Leste or Vietnam?
Vietnam always wins because they're good players, soccer.
Yeah.
But Timorese win maybe sometime like that. Maybe one time like that.
So your boyfriend, he's playing?
Yeah.
Where does he play? Front or back?
At the back.
Oh, you better hurry up.
Just helping the...
Helping the goalkeeper?
Yeah, goalkeeper.
Well, how do you say goalkeeper in Tetu?
Siguranza keeper.
Huh? Oi! And we weren't the only spectator watching this Pan-Asian contest. There were some kids mucking around with a soccer ball, but also a fellow of medium height, blackish hair and glasses, reading an anthropology book. Who was he? Some of the substitutes milling around the sidelines wondered. A talent scout? An out-of-work coach? One of the East Timorese players, Julito, asked me for my podcast recorder as he was intent on finding out more.
So where are you from and what is your name?
I'm Michael Rose. I work at the Australian National University's Development Policy Centre in Canberra.
So what are you doing there?
Good question. I'm an anthropologist and I research labour mobility, so people coming from Timor-Leste to work in Australia, especially in the Pacific Labour Scheme.
So after you get the result from your survey, what do you plan to do? What you will be doing?
The research has a few different parts. There's the survey, and there's also just talking to great people like you, and you're sharing your stories and things. And what we want to do with that, hopefully, is contribute to labour migration policy that is maybe a better fit with the needs of everyone who's participating in it. So which is better for Timorese people like yourself, and which is better for people like midfields who want people to work for them.
Okay, thank you, sir.
No worries.
Yeah. And we couldn't resist pressing Mike further on his answers, so we took him away from the hue and cry that was pitch side for a chat.
I did my fieldwork in Timor-Leste up in the hills of Oikoussi, often trying to understand the stories that the different clans who lived up there sort of told about how they came to be living on this particular mountain, and about how back in the old days they wandered from one place to another and finally they came to settle in the place where they were. And the primary sort of metaphor they used to sort of understand their life and their economy and just who they were was often that of the root and the branch, or the trunk and the tip. And so the sort of the idea was that even though their particular name group, even though their house may be spread out throughout Timor-Leste, it still had its roots in a certain sacred place. And often they'd travel back to this sacred place to sort of pay homage to the ancestors and things like that. And what sort of interested me is the sense, which I often get from the Timorese I talk to here, of this journey to Australia being sort of an extension of these sort of ancestral journeys, this idea that by coming to Australia, they're sort of extending the family's journey still further. But the recognition that the base, the Hun, with which they come from, remains in Timor-Leste is always very strong. And so they come from these extensive family networks and this pervasive norm, that really your reason for being in life is to feed back into that family network. And I think there's often a degree of misunderstanding from people who are looking from an Australian perspective, who through no fault of theirs don't necessarily have a sense of how this works. Someone working in Australia will remit money into their family network, and that will essentially be used for educating children, building houses, feeding people in some cases, or at least enhancing nutrition, medical care, sometimes starting up small businesses. But I guess the point is that having a family member in Australia feeding money back into this Timorese network is sort of enhancing the network's ability to look after its own. It's creating a generation of children who are going to be better educated, housed in sort of more suitable conditions, and just live lives which are a lot less precarious than they otherwise would have been.
And so the borders are closed. How are East Timorese and others actually sending money back so that it lands quickly and efficaciously within their families?
Back when there was travel between the Pacific, Timor-Leste and Australia, people would carry cash back with them. Western Union and various other formal money transfer services certainly have a role. But most major banks these days will let you have something called a travel money card, which is two prepaid debit cards which are linked to your main bank account. And then if you've got two of these cards, often what people will do is send them back to Timor-Leste. And so say your sister in Dili has one of these cards. So sister calls up, she needs $50 in a hurry. You simply pull out your phone, you can transfer $50 from your main savings account to one of these travel money cards. And then she goes to an ATM machine, of which there are now lots around Timor-Leste, and withdraws the money. There's an ATM fee, but that's it. Now, I haven't done the maths on whether that is necessarily the cheapest method. I suspect it is one of them. But I think the main takeaway from that is, even if it does cost people a little bit more, what the Timorese community here tend to appreciate anyway is being able to transfer money instantly and in a way which they feel they have full control over.
The PLS workers we met were driven by the need to get money back to their families, and if need be, would pay a premium to ensure that this happened as quickly and as easily as possible. We met Vicente Pinto in the previous episode, the Japanese embassy worker turned English language teacher turned meat slicer who went by the name of Vinny. Vinny wasn't playing soccer. He was about to call his sister in Dili, and we asked if we could tune in order to get a better understanding of where the money he was earning on the production line was going.
Hello. Oh, hello. How are you? Oh, that's good. Very well, thank you. My name's Julia. What's your name?
Jania. Okay.
Oh, Jania, nice to meet you.
At the moment, I was studying about English. I have to do that from home because university closed. COVID-19 happened in Timor, and we just stay at home. Sometimes I call Vinny to be careful. We talk about to send me money for build one house here.
So it's been very difficult for her to deal with the house construction in Dili at the moment because the COVID-19 makes everyone staying at home because they can't go out to buy things in the market and buy food. So it's very difficult for them to get money and also especially it's difficult for her. She can't go to school or uni because the uni is closed and the no internet at home. She can't access anything from uni or especially from her teachers.
So does that mean there's more need for you to send help home through the form of money?
Yeah, it is. So right now I think she just will rely on me. If everything she needs about money or to buy any food or any clothes, specialty materials for house construction. Just want me to send some money to her.
Can I ask you, what percentage of your salary do you send back?
It depends. Sometimes I send 1,000 to them to try to spend their money for the building house and then buy food during this difficult time. So
can you talk about the economic situation in Dili, and can you talk about the impact on your family of the floods that happened there?
Overall, the economic in Dili is very bad, because everyone is stuck at home and they can't continue, or they can't do any business. And then it is very bad and very difficult for them to live their life there. So the government tries to provide them food. It's called the cesta básica. Mm-hmm. So basically it's like corn, a bag of rice, oil, something like that. And then they can only serve themselves for several days, mm-hmm. and then they have to find their own food. So it's very difficult. Those who just rely on the daily income, for instance, like my mom is a veggie seller, rely on every day when they buy her veggies and can earn a bit of money.
And if she's not selling the vegetables, no money.
No money.
Yeah.
Right now, she stopped. And the floods caused many problems. Many homes were damaged and destroyed. Mm-hmm. And then they had to move and stay in the hostel, and some stay in the
crisis centers.
Or something, church. So, like my house in Dili, which is in Bekora, got flooded. So, it was taken away by the water. All the my sister's clothes, and including books and computer, all gone. So, luckily my mic helped me and drove me to the Rotary donations in Footscray, and then I just sent them some clothes and to wear.
There was not an East Timorese that we met in the Bull that was not materially affected by the Easter floods in Dili. Many, like Vinny, saw much of what they had previously paid for and built washed away. And it's all the harder because of COVID-19. Because of travel restrictions and quarantine requirements, the once-a-year trip back home with the 4 weeks annual leave given by Midfields is off the cards. And the pain of not being able to see one's family overseas is a totalizing ache that only a migrant can know. And the weight of expectations on the East Timorese workers is something that Michael Rose from the Development Policy Centre is acutely aware of.
So most of my friends here, they're not saving all that much money. And so like when they go home, they're not going to start some sort of enormous business. The money is going into what they value most, which is family and community and the next generation. For example, a fairly significant amount of the money that people send home to Timor-Leste goes on various traditional ceremonies.
They're called like Lia Mate, Lia Moris, you know, like ceremonies of death, ceremonies of life, the sense of really being part of a wider whole. Now, the easy way to do would be to scoff and say, oh, well, that money shouldn't be spent on that. It should be spent on setting up a small, medium enterprise. But the world doesn't work that way.
Well, no, it doesn't work that way. It, once again, sort of comes back to the issue of should we be thinking more about labour mobility instead of simply a way of filling gaps in the Australian labour market as a chance for people from abroad to sort of broaden their perspectives and encounter life in Australia on their own terms, no matter where that might take them. And it's just in the same way as you would expect an Australian 19-year-old to go to London and have all sorts of wacky misadventures and spend 5 years losing their money and not really getting anywhere. Like, honestly, I think the average Timorese worker, just because they come from a less coddled place, is actually more sensible than that. But at the same time, there needs to be recognition that this is a big life-changing adventure for the workers who are here, and that they become more accustomed to managing sort of money and work and life in Australia the longer they're here. So we have the Working Holiday Maker Scheme, which is open to people from 44 different countries. And the idea is basically that people will come to Australia and work a bit, but also there'll be sort of cultural and people-to-people connections as the year goes. But with the Seasonal Worker Program and the Pacific Labour Scheme, they're much more work orientated, which brings us to the next point, of course, which is that if we give people under 30 from 44 different countries a chance to come to Australia and have a working holiday, why aren't we doing that for the same age cohort from the Pacific and Timor-Leste? Where I feel we need to be sort of moving from a policy perspective is where we're able to get this sort of balance, recognizing that the young people coming here to pick our fruit are not just coming here to pick our fruit, but also coming here to sort of learn.
I mean, do the East Timorese that are here, do the Pacific Islanders that are here want to stay?
At the moment, there's about 30 Pacific Labour Scheme workers from East Timor in Warrnambool. Just through talking to them about, you know, who would like to stay, who would like to go home, it's probably evenly split. People intensely miss their homeland. They intensely miss their families. On the other hand, they often have large extended families to support, and things in Timor are very hard.
But the people that want to stay can't really stay because there's a three-year hard limit.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So there's a three-year hard limit, which seems to be sort of quite unfair. We know if they do stay, they will continue feeding back both economic and what we call social remittances to Timor-Leste. We've seen this to some extent in the United Kingdom, where there's, you know, supposed to be about 20,000 workers there right now. I mean, I've been to where they were. If we can have 20,000 Timorese working in the UK, and for the most part they're doing a sterling job, why can't we have 20,000 Timorese working in Australia, this neighbouring country which most Timorese, and, you know, rightly or wrongly, have great affection for? It just seems like a great opportunity for both countries on a number of different levels. I personally believe in a more open Australia. Our neighbours in the Pacific are right there. We have only a very small Pacific and Timorese diaspora at the moment. I see no reason why that shouldn't be bigger. I've seen no evidence at all to suggest that in the specific example of Timor-Leste, Timorese diaspora communities lose touch in any way with their homeland. And I just believe that Timor-Leste with roots in Australia is going to be stronger than one which is sort of set adrift as a tiny nation state in Southeast Asia.
Darkness was falling, and the soccer players were tripping back, dreaming of next week. Vietnam had won again. And it was time now for one of the most important events of the weekend, celebrating Pedro Lay's birthday. Pedro was the cleaner from Dili that we met in the previous episode at Midfield Meets, and he was about to turn 40. One of the features that has always perplexed me about East Timorese is that they tend to enjoy their beer warm. They are like the English of the Malay archipelago. We enjoyed our repast over room temperature bottles of Corona beer as well as lukewarm white wine. And as we spoke, toggling between English and Tetun, we all felt a real sense of community here, something that was so indiscernible but real and couldn't easily be captured in a technical report.
Thank you. Before we eat, can someone tell me exactly what we're eating?
Can I say in Tetun?
Please.
Speak English.
Okay. Yeah. Because it's a little bit difficult to explain in English because I don't know some like ingredient that we put there. It's like feok midar. Yeah, Timor. I'm born feok. Timor born feok. This is a sweet potatoes like we put in here like a chili, pepper, and onions. We cook it like slowly, like a steaming cook. But we add a little bit of water, just a little bit, just to make the steam. We put also like the yellow thing, what do you call it? Yeah, tamarind, yes. We add some tamarind also. This is the way we cook the sweet potatoes. But sometimes back in Timor, we just do simple, like just put it in the water and you let it cook. So we also do some like Timorese salad with tomato and onions. But today we add a little bit like Australian style or whatever you call it, like dressing, like a little bit, yeah.
Modern Australia.
Yeah, the dressing, but like, yeah, everybody knows that Timor is like chili, so we try to put everything with chili. So hope everyone enjoy it.
The East Timorese here reminded me in a way of how I felt when I came to live in Dili. Fascinated by the points of difference from where I came from, but profoundly grateful for the opportunity to be here. And the next day, we swapped sweet potato for chipped potatoes, along with some battered fish, as we came for lunch to a house that it was hard to imagine a more heterogeneous collection of people living within. There was a young Fijian man with the build of a scrum half, a middle-aged Filipina woman on a protection visa, an Indonesian vet whose husband is studying for a PhD in Melbourne, a young South Korean on a working holiday visa, and a remarkable 37-year-old woman called Anna, who is the unofficial head of the house.
Let's walk down the street, grab some fish and chips, and we'll bring them back.
Yeah. Which street?
Oh, well, according to Google Maps, it's just down the end of the road.
Okay.
Okay. If he gets lost, then it's your fault.
Oh, sorry.
My dad just passed away, so my mom is alone at home. So we 7 siblings. And I'm a pair of twins. My sister lives in Suva, at the capital city. So she's married with 3 kids, so she's okay with the husband because the husband works at the Australian embassy. So my other siblings, the 5, all of them are not working, so I've been supporting them. That's why I have 2 jobs. Mm-hmm. I was doing 3 jobs, 3 tasks in one department.
You must never sleep.
I do sleep. I do rest my mind, yeah. Last night I was my first shift at Macca's, and the lady that came and asked me, she worked at midfield too. She got injured just in 2 weeks because the work was so hard for her. So, and then she asked me, I told her, I'm working in midfield, I'm still working there. And she asked, what, you're still working there? How can you do this? And I said, well, if I'm doing it for my family, everything is easy. So sending money at home, it makes me happy, because they're happy. Mm-hmm. Especially living in this place, Wanabu, it's same as atmosphere back at home. A bit laid back, relaxed, you just do your own, peaceful, but what I give, and they're happy about it. Yeah. As long as food is on the table, it's okay, because we have land, we cultivate the land, they eat from the land, so the main thing is the sugar, the flour, the oil, those are most important things for them to have.
Anna herself is not on the Pacific Labour Scheme. She's here on another visa category, but her reflections speak to the PLS workers that she's on the line with at Midfields, the friends she shares a house with, as well as the broader migrant experience in Australia.
So what happens if you do get injured over here and you're unable to work? Does the program help you out?
You have to save. Even though you're sending money home, you have to save. I have to save for myself too here, because if something wrong, or even work, there's no work, you'll have to survive on yourself, but on your saving. You cannot be sending money home and thinking of them all the time, but you yourself, your income stability is not okay back here. So that's what I've been learning throughout, ever since I've been staying in Australia.
Yeah.
I've been telling these boys.
Are you listening? Are you saving?
Yeah.
Hopefully it's a year and the money is in the bank.
Yeah. Anna struck me as the sort of person who had more than 24 hours in a day. I simply could not figure out how she was able to accomplish all this work. And that wasn't the half of it. Anna had found also a way, in her packed day already, to give back to the local community.
Oh, volunteer work at St. Joseph Parish. My first Sunday here in Warrnambool, I went to church. After church, I saw the pamphlet, and it was a soup kitchen every Monday. Anybody's welcome. So after church, the first person I met was a lady, and I said, excuse me, ma'am, what's this about the soup kitchen? I said, oh, it's feeding the homeless, the needy, or people on the street. Oh, I want to do this. And then she asked, where are you from? I'm from Fiji. I've been to Fiji, so please do come. They know the culture. The lady, that she knows that we always help. Ever since, I haven't missed a Monday of going to soup kitchen, because it helps me too. Spiritually, it helps. So when I'm there, they know I'm old now. They say, Anna, you the boss. I say, no, I'm doing the dishes. I always do the dishes. They say, no, the person that does the dishes, because it's a big machine, you the boss. So, and I enjoyed it. Very friendly, and I feel good helping people when they have the smile in their face.
And one of the institutions that these migrant communities are helping revitalize and regenerate are Warrnambool's churches, as we found when we went to Mass on Sunday morning at Our Lady Help of Christians to find the majority of the East Timorese soccer squad arriving in their Sunday best, a few clutching guitars with serious intent. Forrester is a man who began his career as a cocktail maker at a high-end hotel in Dili, whose name is Avelino Guterres.
Mostly they call me Alvis, so I'm the one who will prepare the song, what song that we will sing in the mass, and not the hard song that we have to take at least 2 or 3 days. No, we just do some song that possible for everyone to sing. So today we sing 3 songs. It was at the beginning, Solokba, it means we are happy to welcome in the God's house. And the second song, it was about in the communion, it's for our soul, and we call it Te Amare, it's a Portuguese song. And the last one, we provide a Mary of Nazareth song to celebrate Mother's Day as well.
And it sounded beautiful. I mean, what does it mean to you to be able to sing in the church in your own language?
Yeah. It's meaningful to us because for the Tetun it's easier for everyone to sing. Sometimes in Portuguese also, because we used to sing in our country, and some English song that we also have English mass in our country. So we try to mix them up like international one. It's, to worship God is already part of our life. And also it's part of our culture. As a Catholic, we feel so blessed to be here, be a part of the new community, always welcome us. And with their hospitality, it's really amazing. And we also unexpected that this will happen to us, but we know there is someone must be guide us, always put us together in one place.
É difícil agora viver sem lembrar-me de ti. Te amarei, Senhor. Te amarei, Senhor. Eu só encontro a paz e a alegria bem perto de ti. Te amarei.
As Mass ended, many of the East Timorese queued up to touch the feet of the statue of Our Lady that was in the corner of the church. And I saw on my way out that there was a collection plate and a notice for donations to help those impacted by the Dili floods. What the East Timorese are bringing to this parish and to this community is not going unnoticed or underappreciated, as Fiona Torpy, a volunteer at the church, came over to tell us.
No, I think the Timorese community are very much a breath of fresh air in this area in Warrnambool. I just think they contribute so much to the church and our lifestyle. They're just engaging. And I sense from all of them that they really want to better themselves. They want to improve. And most people, they just want to work hard and provide for their family and sustain their life in an honest way through earning a living. I mean, that's all they ask for.
Yeah, and I mean, one of the great shames is that after 3 years, it's kind of hard deadline up and out.
I think it's cruel. They should be rewarded, not punished. I think after working so hard and contributing to the town of Warrnambool, especially in the toughest job here, and it's the most lucrative organisation here in Warrnambool, I think it would be good if they could stay and be part of this community for as long as they would like to be here. And they're a nation that also helped Australians in the past. My mother always said the Timorese looked after us in the Second World War, and I think we easily forget that. And I think that's something that we should be aware of and also embrace them into our life here. And they're just great contributors.
And they play a really big role in the church.
Yes, they certainly do, and they're great singers. We could actually... They'll be good with replacing the choir at this, dare I say. we feel like we're in the islands when they sing, don't we? They're fantastic.
Might Australia do this better if it aimed more at seeding a diaspora through schemes like the PLS, rather than simply bringing workers here temporarily? Those we spoke to in our time in Warrnambool answered with an emphatic and empathetic yes. And believe it or not, that brings us to the end of our first season of Memorandum of Understanding, a journey that began with a food project in Timor-Leste and ended in Warrnambool with the East Timorese diaspora. And in between, we've travelled across the Pacific, Indonesia and parts of Africa. And as we drove back to Melbourne, we reflected on the connective tissue that united all these disparate episodes, and how the traditional language that we use to talk about development, the bureaucratic language of officialdom, the syrupy press release or tweet, or even the careful and precise language of academia, doesn't really fully capture the stories that we heard. We're so grateful that we found so many wonderful guests who had the courage to tell them. This is Memorandum of Understanding. I'm Gordon Peake. The producer is Julia Bergen. Music is from Luther Knut. And special thanks to Dr. Michael Rose from the Development Policy Center for all his work introducing us to the many arms of the Pacific Labor Scheme in Warrnambool. You can find more info on Pacific Labor Mobility, including some blogs written by Mike and the communities in Warrnambool, in the show notes. We're going to take a break. And in the meantime, you can listen to each of the 8 episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up to date with the latest by following us on Twitter at MOU_pod. And please don't forget to leave us a review. See you in a couple of months.